Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. In its annual report published on Wednesday, Amnesty International has called for the five permanent members of the UN Security Council to waive their veto rights in cases where genocide and other mass killings are being committed. Selah Hennessy reports from London.
Speaking to VOA, Amnesty International Secretary General Salil Shetty said 2014 has been a catastrophic year for victims of conflict and violence around the world.
As the world has been looking at what happened in 2014, it's clear that millions of civilians from Syria to Ukraine to Gaza to Nigeria have suffered horrific violence and human rights violations.
Amnesty's report says 2014 saw one of the worst refugee crises in history. It says in Syria, 4 million civilians were displaced by war, while thousands of migrants have died in the Mediterranean. Selah Hennessy for VOA News, London.
Ukraine's military is for the second consecutive day reporting a significant reduction in attacks by pro-Russian rebels, but says a ceasefire has not yet taken hold in eastern Ukraine. Rebels carried out 19 attacks on government-held territory and targets over the previous 24 hours, according to a Facebook statement Wednesday by the Press Center for the Kiev military. U.S. President Barack Obama nominated a diplomat Tuesday to serve as the first U.S. ambassador to Somalia since 1991. The Senate must approve Catherine Denani for the post. If confirmed, she would lead the U.S. mission to Somalia, located in neighboring Kenya. Look at our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The United States demanded Tuesday that Islamic State militants release a group of more than 90 Assyrian Christians they kidnapped during raids in northeastern Syria. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki condemned the attacks and said the militants must release all civilians they are currently holding. A court in Bangladesh issued an arrest warrant Wednesday for former Prime Minister Khalida Zia in connection with two corruption cases after she failed to appear in court. Her lawyers argued she was concerned about safety due to ongoing unrest in Bangladesh and that she's been confined to her office. U.S. President Barack Obama's national security advisor has sharply criticized Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decision to speak before Congress about the U.S.-led talks with Iran over its nuclear program. Mr. Netanyahu has accepted an invitation by House Speaker John Boehner to address a joint meeting of Congress on March 3rd, 2 weeks before Israeli parliamentary elections. In an interview with U.S. television journalist Charlie Rose, Susan Rice said the decision has injected a degree of partisanship to bilateral ties between the United States and Israel. An avalanche in Afghanistan has killed at least 100 people, with the death toll expected to rise, officials said Wednesday. Winter storms hit hardest in the mountainous Panjshir province, north of Kabul. Ongoing fighting between rebel fighters and Myanmar's army on the Chinese border has dislocated tens of thousands of people and raised tensions between the two countries. But on Wednesday, the leader of the rebels denied rumors that he's received help from Chinese citizens or mercenaries. Bill Ide reports from Beijing.
Ethnic Chinese rebel leader Peng Jiasheng recently launched a fight for control of the Kekong region in northern Myanmar, which is close to China's southern border in the province of Yunnan. The fighting, which began on February 9th, has already claimed at least 130 lives, and tens of thousands have fled across the border seeking safety in China. Myanmar has accused Chinese mercenaries of fighting alongside the rebels. It has also asked China to cooperate and prevent what it called terrorist attacks from being launched from Chinese territory. In an interview in the Global Times, which is published by the Communist Party's mouthpiece, The People's Daily, Peng said the participation of Chinese mercenaries would hurt, not help his cause. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
A jury in Texas has convicted a man in the shooting death of a former U.S. Navy SEAL whose life story was turned into the current hit movie American Sniper. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Huhib, and coming up at this hour on Africa News Tonight.
As the world has been looking at what happened in 2014, it's clear that millions of civilians from Syria to Ukraine to Gaza to Nigeria have suffered horrific violence and human rights violations.
That's Amnesty International Secretary General Salil Shetty speaking about the catastrophic year for victims of conflict and violence around the world. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the Somali government is welcoming the nomination of a new U.S. ambassador to Somalia, the first since 1991. And the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan is calling on President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar to bring peace in South Sudan.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Algeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour: in its annual report published today, Amnesty International has called for the five permanent members of the UN Security Council to waive their veto rights in cases where genocide and other mass killings are being committed. Selah Hennessy reports from London.
Speaking to VOA, Amnesty International Secretary General Salil Shetty said 2014 has been a catastrophic year for victims of conflict and violence around the world.
As the world has been looking at what happened in 2014, it's clear that millions of civilians from Syria to Ukraine to Gaza to Nigeria have suffered horrific violence and human rights violations.
Amnesty's report says 2014 saw one of the worst refugee crises in history. It says in Syria, 4 million civilians were displaced by war, while thousands of migrants have died in the Mediterranean. Shetty says wealthy countries make more of an effort to keep migrants out than working to keep them alive, and the crisis will only get worse unless leaders commit political and financial resources to help those who are fleeing danger. This challenge, he says, is only going to become greater as the nature of global conflict continues to change.
The rise of armed groups is one of the striking things. Our report discloses that up to 35 countries are now dealing with serious arms groups. Now, it is the duty of governments and international institutions to protect civilians from mass atrocities, but their response, in our view, was dismal and shameful.
Amnesty International Advocacy Director Steve Crawshaw says one of the most striking failures of 2014 was the consistent abuse of the veto by UN Security Council members. The council was set up after World War II and charged with maintaining international peace and security. It has 15 members, with 5 permanent members, Russia, Britain, France, China, and the United States, who have the right to veto any Security Council resolutions. Last year, the veto was used twice in the council. Russia vetoed a resolution condemning as illegal a referendum on the status of Crimea, and Russia and China blocked a resolution condemning Syria. Steve Crawshaw.
This is a lose-lose situation. The civilians of the world are suffering because of this cozy deal that was cooked up by the powerful members of the Security Council so many years ago.
Amnesty says the permanent members should give up their right to veto in cases where genocide and other mass killings are being committed. Crawshaw says persuading the 5 countries to do so would be an uphill struggle, but is achievable.
The Security Council in New York can sometimes feel a very long way away and somehow removed from all of these issues. It can, of course, be absolutely and very strongly engaged. It's failed on a number of occasions in past years to engage sufficiently for what they would see as geopolitical reasons. They will look away from issues, and I think we need to see an end to that.
Russia says had action in Syria not been blocked, this could have led to President Bashar al-Assad being referred to the International Criminal Court and much greater humanitarian support for civilians. Selah Hennessy for VOA News, London.
The Somali government is welcoming the nomination of a new U.S. ambassador to Somalia, the first since 1991. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports, despite the development, the United States is reluctant to reopen an embassy in the country due to security concerns.
Somali Prime Minister Omar Abdirashid Ali Sharmarka says the nomination of Catherine Denani represents a very positive moment in relations with the United States. Speaking to VOA by phone from Mogadishu, the Prime Minister's office spokesman Ridwan Haji said the timing of the ambassador nomination is particularly good as the country seeks to cement political reforms outlined in a policy plan known as Vision 2016.
This is actually the right time. The year 2015 and the year 2016 is the main 2 years that the government wants to achieve a lot, and the support of the United States of America in terms of security and humanitarian assistance is really important.
If approved by the Senate, Denani will be the first U.S. ambassador to the country since the ousting of former dictator Siad Barre plunged the country into civil war. Denani has served in diplomatic assignments across Africa, including Zimbabwe, Gabon, Zambia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Congo-Brazzaville. She would replace a U.S. special representative who acts as the current envoy to Somalia, operating out of Nairobi, Kenya. A State Department spokesperson announcing the nomination Tuesday said as security conditions permit, the United States will look forward to eventually reopening the U.S. embassy in Mogadishu. Haji said he thinks it is time for the United States to reestablish its diplomatic presence in Somalia.
The ambassador will probably stay in Nairobi at the moment, but the plan is that the embassy will come to Mogadishu to really work very closely with the Somali government.
While the United States has not maintained an official military presence in Somalia since the infamous Black Hawk Down mission in 1993, it has been engaged in anti-terrorism operations in the country. U.S. drones have killed key leaders of the al-Qaeda-linked militant group al-Shabaab, including its top commander Ahmed Abdi Godane, in September. U.S. anti-terror policy in Somalia has also brought controversy. Tough financial rules designed to prevent money from flowing to terror groups has forced banks in the United States to cut money transfer services to Somalia. The move has threatened a key lifeline for many Somalis who depend on remittances from abroad. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says the tide has turned against the Islamic radicals of Boko Haram. In a statement read on state radio today, Mr. Jonathan says the days of mourning victims of incessant terrorist attacks in the country will soon be over as the tide has now definitely turned against Boko Haram. The president says two suicide bombing incidents in northern towns yesterday, Kano and Potiskum, were soft targets that prove Boko Haram is on the decline. Boko Haram is blamed for 10,000 deaths over the last 5 years and the displacement of 1.6 million people.
Security officials say more than 10,000 Egyptians have fled from Libya since Islamic militants released a video of the beheading of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians more than a week ago. The chief of security at a border crossing at the city of Seloum says 2,000 to 3,000 Egyptians have returned each day for more than a week. Fawzi Nayel says many came from Sirte, the central city where the executions are reported to have occurred. Many Egyptians have entered Libya looking for work.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Somali government is welcoming the nomination of a new U.S. ambassador to Somalia, the first since 1991. And Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says the tide has turned against the Islamic radicals of Boko Haram. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The international humanitarian organization Save the Children continues to call for better rescue and protection efforts for migrants, especially children who risk their lives by crossing the Mediterranean Sea, seeking safety and a better life. The organization has been assisting accompanied and unaccompanied minors who have landed in Lampedusa, Italy. Save the Children cites that since the beginning of 2015, about 3,709 migrants have landed in Italy, including 195 women and 390 children, 149 of them unaccompanied and 241 accompanied. Michela Prosperi is a spokesperson for Save the Children in Lampedusa. He provided insight into what happens to children once they arrive on the island.
Save the Children has deployed on the ground here in Lampedusa Island, but also in Sicily, Calabria, and Apulia, who are the three southern regions in Italy where the migrants land after being boarded in Libya. What Save the Children is doing is providing assistance and support to the underage children among the migrants group arriving by sea. Our activity is meant to provide support both to accompanied children who are with an adult member of their family, but specifically to unaccompanied minor who are the most vulnerable. The average age is 16, but they are also very, very young, like 9, 10, 11, or 12.
What kind of condition are they in when they arrive there?
You should think about the experience they went through before crossing the sea. They come from the country of origin, who are country where they were suffering from hunger, violence, or no opportunity for the future, or even conflicts like civil war. And so they come from sub-Saharan countries or West Africa countries and from Syria, as well as being refugees. So they've already had a travel that can, you know, last weeks or months, where they get kidnapped, they assist or suffer from violences of any kind. And in the end, they get on the boats in the hands of traffickers to cross the sea. And these sea crossings are really treacherous. And sometimes we know that they become traumatic and can also be a cause of death for a few of them, as happened last week, where more than 300 people dead at sea after capsizing.
What types of services are you all providing for these children?
First of all, we provide a legal information, a legal briefing to them in order to help them understand where they arrived, what are their rights, and what will happen to them. Have been underage, they have the right to be received and protected in Italy independently from the willing to ask for international protection. So we explain them all the chances they have to start the integration path in Italy, or if they have parents or relatives, they may have the chance to reach in other European countries. We try to facilitate the family reunification procedure. And then we work visiting all the reception facilities, keep monitoring the reception conditions, and also to make a referral activity for the specific needs like health support, psychological support, or any specific needs that they may have.
How many children are there that you all are working with?
In the past year, they were 24,000 children, the half being unaccompanied children. And we can say not 100%, but you know, most of them given support to them. This year, since the 1st of January until the 20th of February, a total of 7,400 migrants arrived in Italy, and among them there were 700 children that we met at the landing areas, we are visiting at the reception facilities, keep providing them support they need.
What happens to those children who don't have any family members, who are just there alone?
They have the chance to start their integration path in Italy. Few of them want to reach other destinations in North Europe, so not rarely they flee from the reception facilities to step forward in their travel on their own, exposing themselves to the risk of exploitation and also to put themselves in the hands of people smugglers again. This is something that depends on the country of origin of the unaccompanied minor. You know, most of those coming from Eritrea, they usually want to reach North Europe countries like Scandinavian countries, Germany, or even UK. And so what they do is that they flee from the reception facilities, step forward with the train, the trip to North Italy, and then across the border. to the non-European countries. For the sub-Saharan, the company minor, they really look on the West Africa as well. They really look for an opportunity in Italy. So they want to go in the children homes where they have to be placed in order to start the integration path. That includes learning Italian, having some training, possibly go to school and step forward in their opportunity to have a chance for a future in Italy.
That was Michele Prosperi, a spokesperson for Save the Children. He spoke with me from the island of Lampedusa.
The World Bank and Japan launched a project in two counties in Liberia to recruit a core of mental health counselors to help school children recover from the personal and family impacts of the Ebola crisis. The Carter Center will operate the project with $3 million grant from the Japanese Social Development Fund. Counseling will be conducted in schools in two counties, Margibi and Monserrado, where Monrovia is located. Meanwhile, in Sierra Leone, communities are reportedly detaining men infected with the virus who have had sex with women and placed them at risk of infection. The World Health Organization is sending staff to Bombali, a district northeast of the capital Freetown, to determine conditions under which men have been detained. WHO's Margaret Harris in Geneva expressed concern that any incarceration of Ebola victims would be harmful to efforts to reach zero-level infections by further stigmatizing Ebola victims. Health experts believe men may retain the virus in their sperm for up to 90 days after recovery from the virus. Public campaigns have encouraged recovering males to abstain for 3 months.
A new study suggests reforms to help improve United Nations peacekeeping operations around the world. It includes the better matching of mandates with mission capacity and resources and clarifying expectations surrounding UN troop deployments. William Eagle reports from Washington.
The goal of the study is to provide input to a new UN review that will update peacekeeping operations. It sought feedback on potential reforms from stakeholders, including governments and policymakers, in Africa and other world regions. Among their concerns are new challenges to traditional peacekeeping, including the spread of international criminal networks and jihadists who cross poorly guarded borders, especially in Africa. The author of the report is Yahir Vanderlein, head of peace operations research at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Vanderlein says there are steps that can be taken in UN missions like that in Mali, where improved explosive devices and suicide bombers have put peacekeepers at risk.
For example, only in last year, I think about 30 peacekeepers were killed due to such attacks in Mali alone. That's about three-quarters of all deaths as a result of attacks in total. If you start to look at all the incidents, then you find that most of those casualties, fatalities, are the result of IEDs that killed people because the vehicles that they were traveling in were not proof for IED proof. So just making sure that particularly Chadian soldiers travel in Mali with the required armed personnel carriers would already save a lot of lives.
Vanderlein says African stakeholders consulted for the study support robust peacekeeping operations that include the use of force to protect civilians. He says many emerging nations, including China, Russia, Turkey, South Africa, Indonesia, India, and Brazil, are reluctant to accept robust missions in their own regions, but are supportive of the use of force in Africa. They benefit from African stability for trade and access to the continent's natural resources. But he says they and other nations that contribute troops sometimes have second thoughts about putting their own forces at risk.
That's why you see in some operations that the operations remain passive not necessarily because the mandate is passive. No, quite often the mandate of an operation is very robust and says you should intervene and you should protect civilians. Not necessarily because the force commander of the peace operation doesn't want to do it, but quite often because the troop contributor in the end decides that they think it is too dangerous to actually protect the civilians. So your commander, the force commander of the peace operation, should be in charge. In practice, they basically have a second line of command, and that's their own capitals. And that is a problem that the UN, they are aware of, and they're trying to find solutions.
Von der Leyen says the UN must make clear the mandates of UN peace operations. For example, he says civilians have been confused about whether the mandate includes a blanket guarantee to protect everyone or only some, as he says is the case in Mali, South Sudan, and the Eastern Congo. He says troops must also be well-equipped to carry out the mission's mandate. He gave the example of the mission in Kivu province in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
The mission was just not sufficiently equipped to protect all civilians. So what should a mandate do and how should you manage expectations? You should explain to the population what you will do and what you're not going to do. Are you going to protect all civilians of the whole country? Well, that's what people right now expect in DRC, and that's why they are quite often angry at the UN peacekeepers, because they are not protected everywhere.
The study also revealed tensions between nations that finance operations and often make the decisions, mostly Western industrialized countries, and middle and low-income states that provide troops. He says the troop providers are critical of financing nations, who in turn often criticize the performance and training of the forces. Von der Leyen suggests that countries that provide funding also provide more troops, while those who traditionally send troops should find ways to increase their financial contributions. This would increase understanding between the two groups of countries. He says the dispute has been calmed in the last year by increased financial reimbursements to low-income countries providing soldiers. There are 16 peace operations with 120,000 UN personnel around the world. 9 of them, with about 81,000 personnel members, are in sub-Saharan Africa. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza is bidding for a third term in June's election. We'll discuss why the move is stirring controversy. That's next time on VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today, because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing. So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The Somali government is welcoming the nomination of a new U.S. ambassador to Somalia, the first since 1991. And Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says the tide has turned against the Islamic radicals of Boko Haram. Coming up, we'll have music from Algeria and in our feature segment, Unreliable Electric Power Supply in South Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with the Yehia Swuhi Band. We're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with boxing today.
Kim, it's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moweta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, amigo.
Nnamdi, what the world has been waiting for has arrived. So says Floyd Mayweather.
Like I always say, for every fight, everybody had a game plan. As of right now, there's not a blueprint on how to beat Floyd Mayweather. No one has found the way to break the Mayweather code.
May 2nd, he'll finally go against Manny Pacquiao.
I'm Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines.
We're going to talk about different aspects of this fight, Nnamdi. But first off, why did it take so long to make this fight happen?
Sonny, if you take a look at the players outside the ring, you don't have Manny Pacquiao owned by HBO, which is the biggest pay television company in the U.S., Floyd Mayweather owned by Showtime. And then you have the promoters and the players and the movers and shakers on both sides. You have Bob Arum on one side. And then you have this character we call Al Heyman with Floyd Mayweather. So making this deal was just not easy with all these guys on the side. Because suddenly we're talking about big, big money.
And in terms of big, big money, Nnamdi, how much can Pac-Man and Mayweather possibly make from this fight?
Well, we have to go to the split, Sonny, because the split has been the problem in the beginning. In the beginning, Manny Pacquiao wanted a 50-50 split, and Mayweather said no way. So they agreed on 60-40. The 60-40 of $200 million, Sonny, you do the calculation. Mm. That is $120 million for Floyd, Money Man Mayweather, and $80 million for Manny Pacquiao.
Mm.
But that's not the end of it.
Does that include the pay-per-view numbers?
Well, Sonny, when we say $200 million, that's guaranteed, which means Uncle Sam will take a cut of it. When we add the closed circuit and the foreign rights and all together in the one bowl, we are looking at these two guys walking away with close to $300 million plus.
What about the box office numbers, Nnamdi? I got to believe the tickets are going to sell out at the MGM Grand in Vegas. So what are they going to go for?
Sonny, man. The cheapest ticket so far, face value is $1,000. When the boys buy it up and resell it, that one G ticket will go for like five. That's nosebleed we're talking about. then if you're a Hollywood player, you're not going to the nosebleed. You want to be ringside. Then we're talking about you dropping 10G, 10 grand.
Mm.
Crazy paper, bro.
Crazy paper indeed, Nnamdi. Nnamdi, let's look at the timeline. The fight's on May 2nd. Is it enough time for these guys to prepare? And also the promotion of the fight. I was kind of expecting that they'd go on a worldwide tour of all these big cities. Is that still going to happen?
Sonny, these two fighters are disciplined fighters. These are not like your heavyweight that puts on 30, 40 pounds between fights and looks lazy and spend another 2-3 weeks in the camp trying to lose weight. These guys, they're already in fighting shape. So for them, they really need 3 good weeks of preparation. There's no worldwide press conference in London. You know, only 2 press conferences will happen. One in the big city, Los Angeles, and one in New York. That's it. In terms of promotion, come on, Sonny. I mean, the mainstream media, everybody, you have two major players in cable TV going toe-to-toe to make this happen. So there's no need to really be banging the drums. People have been waiting for this fight for the past 6 years, Sonny.
What's your sense, Namdi, in Africa and in Europe? Are they really excited about this fight?
Sonny, worldwide, Asia, Africa, the UK, Brazil, everybody wants to see this one fight. Mind you, this is the first major fight since 2007, Oscar De La Hoya, Mayweather. Or you say 2013, Mayweather, Canelo. Those fights, the 2.4 million views with Mayweather and De La Hoya, and 2.2, Canelo and Mayweather. So we're looking at, when you add all this closed circuit, worldwide rights and other stuff, you're looking at close to 4 million buy.
Namdi, what about the live gate at the MGM Grand?
Sonny, the MGM Grand Casino is 16,000 people. When you scale it, the biggest gate so far was Canelo Mayweather. That was $20 million. They're projecting at 16,000, you're talking about nosebleed for $5,000 and the ringside for close to 20, 30 grand. They're projecting $40 million.
So they're going to double that.
Definitely going to double that. And not only that, the pay-per-view is not going to be your regular $60, $65, $75. No way.
How much is that going to be?
It's going to run you close to 120.
Ooh. I guess I better invite a few friends over then, Namdi.
You have no choice, but you also have to charge them for coming into your crib, you know.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta. And we'll hear more verbal jabs from Namdi later this week, right here on the sunny side of sports.
Galala. Great show, bro.
In African club football, fans across the continent are looking forward to another big weekend of action in the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup competitions. Our African football guru, David Legg, says in the Champions League, a top Ivorian club is in a precarious position in Mali.
Seaways Sport of Ivory Coast. Now, they reached the final of the CAF Confederations Cup last year and were beaten by a goal deep in stoppage time by Al Ahly. They're in dire danger of going out of the Champions League at the very first hurdle. They were surprisingly beaten 2-1 at home by Kaloum of Guinea. One ray of hope, perhaps, for the Ivorians is that the second match will not be played in Guinea because of that Ebola epidemic situation. It will be played in Bamako in Mali. So rather than a home venue for Kaloum, it's a neutral venue. But nevertheless, Kaloum with two away goals, they're in a strong position. And this will be a real surprise because in recent years, Seaway have been doing very well. They reached the group stage of the Champions League. And then last December reached the final of the CAF Confederation Cup. So a potential shock there. El Merak of Sudan, Sonny, they're among the most ambitious clubs in Africa. They're really desperate to get their hands on some silverware. And let's just consider for a moment their build-up to their first match against Azam of Tanzania, which they lost by 2-0 in Dar es Salaam. They started off with a training camp in Cairo. They then moved to Doha in Qatar. They had another training camp there. They then played Schalke, a German Bundesliga club, and actually did pretty well, getting a 2-2 draw. All that in advance of their first match in the Champions League. But a disappointment for them, a 2-0 away defeat, and now in the steamy heat of Omdurman, they've got to wipe out that 2-goal deficit. Biggest danger, Sonny, always with 2-0 deficits, is that away goal rule. If Azam score just one goal in Omdurman, Merak will have to score 4 goals to qualify. So that one hanging on a knife edge. The Merak coach, Diego Garzito, he's a Franco-Italian. He's already tasted Champions League glory in 2009 with TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo. So he knows all about this competition. And I'm wondering if he's not thinking, let's try and win this match 2-0. Take it to a penalty shootout where we'll have home advantage. Anyway, one way or the other, a real cliffhanger in prospect there. Another team that I think would have expected to have a slightly easier passage into the final 32 are Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa. They were drawn against Township Rollers of Botswana in the preliminary round. And the general expectation was that Chiefs would win by 2 or 3 goals. But that's not how it worked. In fact, they needed a last-minute goal from Tefu Mashamaite to get a 2-1 home victory. And I can just visualize now, Sonny, the situation in the National Stadium in Gaborone on Saturday afternoon. It's going to be very hot. Hopefully there'll be some clouds in the sky just to make it a little easier for the players. There's going to be 30,000 Botswana supporters backing their team. There'll probably be quite a few fans coming across the border from South Africa as well. So a fantastic situation developing there. And Rollers know if they can win 1-0, they'll go through on the away goal rule. If they win 2-1, it would go to penalties. But if Chiefs, even if they lost but scored 2 or more goals, they would qualify in the away goal rule. So fascinating situation. I've still got a hunch that Chiefs will make it. One of their officials recently claimed they're as good a club as anyone in the world. Well, if that's the case, Sonny, they're going to have to roll those Rollers over. The other South African team, Mamelodi Sundowns, they also disappointed. You know, this is a recurring theme year after year. South African clubs who boast that they play in this great league called the South African Premiership. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty of African football, we just don't see all this great football from these great clubs. Now, Sundowns, they went to St. Michel United of the Seychelles, and it was not unfair to expect that Sundowns would win even on the Indian Ocean Island by a couple of goals, but instead it was St. Michel who took the lead, and Sundowns needed a goal from their Zimbabwean playmaker, Kama Biliat, 7 minutes from time to snatch a 1-1 draw. However, that said, I would expect Sundowns to win pretty comfortably the second leg in Pretoria. Mogram Tetouan of Morocco. Now, there's a club who are not having the best of times lately. They played in Morocco in the FIFA Club World Cup. There were high expectations that they could go far in that competition. But they went out in the first round to those part-timers from New Zealand, Auckland City. And now they're facing elimination at the preliminary stage from the Champions League as well. They lost 2-0 away to CO Bamako of Mali. And they're in a similar situation to El Merak of Sudan. They know that if they can see the goal at home, that may well be the end of their Champions League hopes. So some really fascinating ties, Sonny, coming up. 23 in all. Ashanti Kotoko of Ghana, they've already qualified. East End Lions of Sierra Leone withdrew. But lots of action ahead and certainly the prospect of some shock results.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, unreliable electric power supply in South Africa. And next, the plight of Zimbabwe's expatriates. But first, some music. Here is Idir and Nadia from Algeria with Armand Père.
Survie, mon père. patrimoine, c'est pour toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi, que je tais mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant. Face à ton destin, n'oublie jamais que le respect sera toujours comme la racine de notre famille. Tu es ma fille.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, loin de sa terre. À mon père, qui sans lire et sans écrire a su faire de sa vie mon devenir.
C'est par toi que survit mon patrimoine, c'est pour toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi, que je tais mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
Tu sais, bah, il y a des choses entre une fille et son père qui ne se disent pas chez nous. Mais une chose est sûre, c'est que tu m'as toujours dit de respecter les autres et de travailler dur, dur pour aller toujours plus loin, toujours plus haut. Et tu m'as rendue citoyenne du monde.
Parce que Ziram se veut d'être l'homme libre, tu porteras ce nom comme on porte le destin. C'est un peu de moi, même si je ne te le dis pas. Je suis entre tes mains comme l'eau sacrée d'un pays, citoyenne de ce monde.
Idir Nadia from Algeria with her mom père.
Well, South Africa's state utility Eskom is implementing an aggressive schedule of electricity load shedding to prevent the grid from collapsing. Meanwhile, the unreliable power supply is prompting consumers to become more self-sufficient, producing energy in their own homes from cleaner, renewable sources. Jillian Parker has more from Johannesburg, where keeping the lights on has become a challenge.
Eskom, which provides South Africa with around 95% of its electricity, has said there is a high probability of almost daily controlled power cuts for the next few months to avert a total system collapse. Years of poor maintenance, non-cost reflective tariffs and underinvestment are partly to blame. Adding 7 million people to the grid since the beginning of democracy in 1994, and delays in new plant openings have also stretched its ageing fleet of 27 plants to the breaking point. Frustrated with epileptic power supply, South Africans are considering alternative power sources to reduce their dependence on the ailing grid. Renewables currently only meet about 2% of South Africa's 30,000 megawatt needs.
Here you got panels, right along here you got panels on the back. The whole roof has got panels. Anyways, north face.
Engineer Greg Ball depends on Eskom generated power to supplement 5% of his family's energy needs. Vast solar panels that cover the roof of his Johannesburg home meet the rest of their demand with surplus electricity to power two electric cars.
You know, you think, well, what kind of world are your kids going to grow up in? You know, they're going to witness the end of oil. Weather patterns that are extreme, I mean, they're going to experience a lot.
You have to start developing an environmental conscience. I don't want to be somebody that sort of goes through my whole career business doing the same old, and then dumping all these issues and problems onto my kids. If we can make just a very small difference individually, collectively, it will be significant.
Detractors contend that coming off the grid is a luxury for those who can afford it. To equip the Ball family home with solar technology cost over $30,000. Ball argues that he has recouped the expense, saving about $7,500 annually on fuel alone. Despite initial outlays, several solar companies in Johannesburg told VOA that recent power constraints have triggered a dramatic uptick in interest. Ryan Beach is part of a Go Green project for Parkhurst, an affluent Johannesburg suburb. The ambitious project aims to take all 2,000 houses off the grid and running on renewable energy by 2020.
It's going to be a complete going green from A to Z project. So we're currently investigating all the technology out there, from hydrogen to solar to wind, to doing feasibility studies and looking at all possibilities. And it's basically going to be, a game changer for the country that other neighbourhoods will also follow.
With local governments earning approximately 25 billion rand, or about $2 billion a year from water and marked up electricity, there is likely to be resistance to losing 2,000 customers who pay some of the highest rates in the country. But energy experts say South Africa must embrace cleaner energy and end its reliance on coal. As the fourth largest coal exporting country in the world, South Africa's coal-generated power makes it one of the world's top carbon emitters. Energy expert Chris Yelland argues the government should be looking at sustainable and greener energy options.
No longer is coal a source of cheap energy for South Africa. It's also becoming a burden because of the CO2 emissions or the carbon footprint of Eskom, which is huge. There's a lot of good reasons why we should diversify away from coal. And there's also a lot of good reasons, in my opinion, to diversify away from a single monopoly electricity supplier, especially one that is in financial trouble, that is operational trouble and has environmental problems because of this dependence on coal.
Eskom's financial woes could mean higher tariff costs in the future, which could encourage more people to turn to renewable energy. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's expatriates send back home $800 million in remittances each year. Some want the government to use it for social and economic development. They say the government needs to improve relations with the expatriate community to encourage their investment dollars. Reporter Gibbs Dubey talked to mobile phone businessman Jerry Dumani in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania and Prosper Chitambara, an economist with the Labor and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe.
Any form of remittance targeting or going to Zimbabwe is definitely helpful. But most importantly, I think most Zimbabweans, as far as I'm concerned, do not have social welfare. You know, the people who are in the diaspora are their social welfare. So if folks here are not sending money home, then people at home are in trouble. We're seeing money being used in many fronts. But most importantly, I think we are all aware at this point that the Zimbabwean government is actually benefiting a lot from money that comes from outside. It's coming at a macro level as well as at a micro level.
Mr. Chitambara, what is your view on this?
Definitely, I think there is a huge benefit to the economy, number one, in terms of propping up consumer spending. I think what these remittances are actually doing is that they are supplementing the meager incomes that guys here in Zimbabwe are actually earning. And so that obviously helps to boost consumer spending in the economy, and ultimately it also helps to boost aggregate demand, I think, which is a key pillar in terms of economic growth. Then what it also does is that it serves as a social protection or social welfare mechanism that helps to mitigate the impact of extreme poverty among households. So I think the economies or the advantages are on those two macro levels in terms of, number one, boosting consumer spending, and number two, social welfare mechanism or mitigation strategy against poverty.
And then we see, Mr. Dumani, that whenever you send money home, you expect people to make some worthwhile investment. At the same time, you'll be taking care of your own welfare this side. How do you take into account some of those challenges?
It's a bit of a challenge, I think. One thing for sure is life in the U.S., and I can say maybe I cannot speak for people in other markets like in Europe, for instance. But I think we are all fundamentally the same. We bear the same challenges. We live here in the U.S. We have expectations financially that we have to meet. Now, our obligations to the home country, they also create an additional strain. But it's a strain that you can never run away from. And without that particular, tethering, from people in the diaspora and people at home, I think fundamentally we are all lost.
And adding on to this one, Mr. Chitambara, can you see some kind of projects that are being done by people in Zimbabwe that are actually benefiting from the diaspora?
The activities are more concentrated in the non-formal or in the informal sector. And as you know, there is a big disjuncture between the formal and the non-formal, and the linkages are very, very weak. So most of the activities are being done on a subsistence level. So these are not like serious businesses that are being done by people, but I think these are just businesses to enable people to be able to eke out a livelihood. You know, times are hard in the economy at the moment. The slowdown, the recession in the economy is actually worsening. Companies are closing. So most of the guys found themselves in the non-formal economy or in the what we call the informal sector.
Now, back to you, Mr. Dumani. So is there any way that maybe the diaspora can be creative by coming out with, let's say, a big package for Zimbabwe? Maybe they form an insurance company or a big company and then run it. Is that not possible?
there are attempts that are being made at individual level. Money gets sent, but there is some kind of abuse of that financial aspect. I think there is a broken trust. At a corporate level, we're not seeing a lot of direct investment going to Zimbabwe. Yes, we're seeing attempts by individuals, but those are falling away. But I think there is a need for us to look at an involvement of the governance. The governance needs to improve in terms of make it attractive for folks who are coming from outside to I don't want to sound like a textbook, but you really have to work on incentivizing the diasporans to come back home, invest human capital. That's the most important part. You start with the capital.
That was reporter Gibbs Dube talking to Zimbabwe expat Jerry Dumani and economist Proper Chitambara of the Labor and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since 2009, when it began a campaign to overthrow the government of Nigeria and establish a regime based allegedly on a strict interpretation of Islamic law, the criminal terrorist group known as Boko Haram has wreaked death and destruction across much of that nation's northern half. It has perpetrated countless unprovoked attacks on men, women, and children in their homes, schools, places of worship, and businesses, claiming thousands of lives and forcing hundreds of thousands to flee their homes. Over time, Boko Haram has taken the battle to Nigeria's neighbors in Benin, Chad, Cameroon, and Niger, causing additional death and mayhem. Recognizing the expanding regional nature of the terror group, the United States has provided support in the region in confronting it. Now, as nations in the region mount a major military offensive against the group under the leadership of the African Union and the Lake Chad Basin Commission, we are increasing our support for these efforts. This commitment is firm and will continue for as long as the nations in the region welcome it. We are fully committed to helping the security forces defend their national territories. Boko Haram must not be allowed to continue brutally terrorizing innocent civilians anywhere. This unchecked killing must stop. The United States stands firmly with the governments of Benin, Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria in the face of this serious threat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza is bidding for a third term in June's election. We'll discuss why the move is stirring controversy. That's next time on VOA Africa.